Well, we have a bit to talk about tonight on this Wednesday night edition of the pod. Four games, but obviously we have to talk about those two classics in OKC and in Cleveland. We'll get to some of Raps Wiz as well. Probably going to barely discuss Houston and Minnesota. We didn't watch that much of that game. That largely went according to form. I'll leave it up to you, Danny. Which one of these two crazy games do you want to start with?
I think we have to start with OKC against Utah. And I think it's a good place to start with this game to, instead of starting with the comeback, start with what led to what preceded the comeback. And that was a game that would have been a somewhat remarkable conclusion for Oklahoma City season, because it encapsulated so many of the frustrations that the two of us in particular have had about the Thunder in this series, because they didn't fix anything. They were getting tough shots, they were taking tough shots, and on the other end, Utah was just unloading open threes on them, starting from the middle of the second quarter and basically not letting up until everything left.
Well, it was even earlier than that. I mean, you remember when we switched over to it was like, you know, 8-7 or something. And then the Jazz went absolutely crazy and put up 34 first quarter points. I think it was five consecutive threes from the combination of Ingles and Crowder, four of which were just wide open shots. And again, it was this crazy OKC strategy of bringing Steven Adams 25 feet from the basket to, a lot of times it was Ricky Rubio, sometimes it was Mitchell. I don't think either of them was defensible by this point in the series to be defending that way, but certainly not with Rubio. And the Jazz, that left then the backside defender on the pick and roll just completely in no man's land between the roll man, and Gobert is a solid roll man, so his favors, or just the backside corner three-point shooter. And the Jazz have excellent backside corner three-point shooters, especially when it's Joe Ingles, who is right up by, might have even led the NBA in three-point shooting this season. And so they just got lit up, and it was only a flurry from Paul George once Westbrook had checked out of the game that kept them that close. He hit a number of difficult contested shots in the end of the first quarter, so the Jazz led it 34-29. Then the Jazz defense really went to work, because they gave up more threes, and OKC really struggled offensively in the second quarter, ended that quarter with a mere 12 points. They lost that 22-12. It's 15 at halftime, and then the Jazz with just more threes. I mean, this one was even more asinine. It's just pick and pop, Crowder three-pointer wide open at the top of the key as they double team Ricky Rubio. It was just so incredibly annoying. And then OKC got absolutely nothing on the offensive glass. Steven Adams again had only one offensive rebound in this game, and they weren't getting anything in transition. They only had five fast break points at halftime, and so Utah took a 25-point lead in this game, and then Rudy Gobert got his fourth foul.
Yeah, and that really does appear to be the inflection point of this game, because when Gobert got his fourth foul, it was pretty much set that even if he played in that third quarter, it was going to be very limited. That ended up being very important later on. And OKC, with the knowledge that he was going to be out, there were two big things that happened. One was their players, most notably Russell Westbrook and Paul George, were emboldened to attack more zealously than they have in the career, or sorry, in this series, but also in the last like 2-3 years for Paul George. And whether you want to tie that in with Gobert and, you know, the feedback loop, the idea that they weren't getting as many looks in transition, Utah's offense went ice cold as well. And those were both incredibly important parts.
Well, it started with two Westbrook three-pointers, and he was 5 of 9 from three. He played the entire second half, had only done that once before in his career, which was game 7 in Golden State in the series they lost in 2016. 45 points, 7 assists, 15 rebounds. But it was really those two three-pointers to get the lead right back from 25 to under 20. And then Jeremy Grant checked in for Carmelo Anthony. And I give much more of the credit to OKC's defense. Once again, they were that unit that flew around that we remember from that game that Melo missed in Oakland, among other times this season. And they started switching everything with Adams, who could do that. The Jazz could not get anything going all of a sudden. They're not a very good one-on-one team. They tried a little bit of that strategy back in, I want to say, game 2, and I thought they had okay success with it. Favors got a couple of post-ups, but Gobert was out of the game. Favors generally had a tougher matchup, and they had the length to deal with everything as well. And so now Utah is trying to go one-on-one every time. Ricky Rubio took some horrible shots. You got Jay Crowder playing to his worst instincts, even though he had hit a Jazz record 6 three-pointers. He took some bad ones on the end. Somehow got 27 points, though, because he made up for many of the missed shots that he had missed this season in both Cleveland and Utah. And that, to me, it was all about the defense. I know Westbrook was unbelievable. George was unbelievable. They both played the whole second half, 45 and 44 minutes. But to me, it was all about the Thunder going to a smarter defensive scheme with better defensive personnel.
That definitely was central in what they did. And so by the rough count that I did during that 9 minutes and 23 seconds, and Gobert ended up playing a little bit in this. We'll get to that in a second. Utah had 20 trips down the floor offensively. They were 4 of 16 from the field. They grabbed 2 offensive rebounds. They were 2 of 9 from 3. And they had 4 possessions that ended in a turnover, 2 of which were steals. So 4 makes, 4 turnovers, and 4 free throws during that time is just incredible defense.
The rest of the quarter? Or
yeah, that's just the 9:20. Right. That the 9:20 in at the end of the third. Because by the point the third quarter ended, Oklahoma City had already come all the way back. The comeback occurred in the third quarter. They went down 25 and then came back all within that third quarter. And then the fourth quarter became this slugfest.
Yeah, it was 71-46 was the Jazz biggest lead. And at that point, we actually switched away from the game. We switched back after Westbrook hit a couple of threes in a row and it started to get back towards 15. But I mean, I didn't want to count them out, but you felt like this was over and the postmortems were being written on this OKC season. And then in the fourth quarter, you mentioned the slugfest.
Yeah. Well, before we get to the fourth quarter, there's one other massive thing that happened in this. Right. So Quinn Snyder, you know, it's unraveling. He goes back to Gobert with 4 fouls. And it was crazy how this happened because Gobert comes back in and he's being pretty judicious about not committing the foul himself.
Yeah, and by the way, we should mention that his fourth foul, there was like literally zero contact on Anthony. And they didn't show a great replay of it. Maybe they must have thought that he like swiped down, but he was like a good foot away from Carmelo. And that was, you know, basically Carmelo's sole contribution in the game was he actually put 2 fouls on Gobert in the third quarter.
So then Gobert comes back in. He actually gets to the line at one point, and then he grabs an offensive rebound off of Royce O'Neal miss, and for reasons that I'm not sure I'll ever be able to process, he's backing on Alex Abrines, of all people, and just wraps his left arm around Abrines as he's trying to get into a shot. Easy call for the referee to make. I mean, Gobert's arms are huge. It goes all the way around Abrines' body, basically. And easy fifth foul. That happens with 3:46 to go, so because they brought him back in at about the 5-minute mark. And then he has 5 fouls, and then it gets into a much more complicated scenario with Quinn Snyder because he can't go back to him as quickly because it's only one foul until Gobert is gone.
Yeah, and it's interesting with the big lead, you think, okay, we'll be conservative here. And I'm not saying I'm advocating this, but it's just an interesting thought is we're up 25. If you don't take Gobert out with the 4 fouls, you could say, well, you know, if they come back, we need him to stanch the bleeding. But maybe the bleeding never happens to begin with if you keep him in there. Now, I think almost every coach in the world with 25-point lead probably would have taken him out, gone with the conservative play there. But it is interesting to think about that. Then the fourth quarter, the switching still occurred. They went back to Anthony, which was a surprise, rather than Grant. I thought that was quite foolish. And in fact, Anthony did get beaten a few times by Mitchell in particular. But Mitchell was really the only one who could do anything on a switch. And the Jazz really weren't doing much to set screens, then roll to the rim, try to get guys on their back. You know, they hadn't really been executing against a switching system during this playoff series. And you imagine that we're going to see more of that from OKC going forward. In fact, you would have to say, given how awful their defense was, that it is probably extremely foolish for Donovan not to have tried something else before this, when you see the results they're trying to get with just even a slightly, you know, with any kind of more conservative scheme against this Utah team. And so it was really, I mean, the defense is what drove it. They did get out in transition. George was going to the rim. You mentioned that. I mean, he was just like going through Gobert, who didn't want to pick up fouls, going through Favors. I mean, he wasn't like blowing by guys, but he was just finishing with such strength, knocking guys out of the way at the rim. And we really had not seen that from him in quite some time. His inability to get to the rim in this series had been a big problem for them. He also had another one of his signature snake the pick and roll and step back for a 3 that helped to ice the game in the fourth quarter. And Utah just couldn't figure out a way to score. You know, Favors, he was also in foul trouble. They didn't finish with the Favors and Gobert combo, which I really thought they should have, although the game was probably pretty much out of reach by that point when it would have made sense to bring them both back with the five fouls. That was their best lineup. They couldn't stop Thunder, so maybe you would have thought that you'd go with your better defensive lineup. But Crowder had been hot, so maybe they felt like they had to leave him out there. Maybe they even could have just gone away from Rubio and gone with Ingles, Crowder, and Mitchell on the perimeter with Favors and Gobert. I thought that Rubio took some really, really weird, questionable floating two-pointers that just there's no explanation for pretty early in the clock. As well, Royce O'Neal didn't give them anything as well. That Dante Exum only played 2 minutes. He might have actually even been able to help them a little bit. And so I thought OKC, even when they had Melo out there, even when they had Abrines out there, those guys got attacked a little bit, but it still just wasn't enough for this Utah team that has one one-on-one creator, essentially.
And Russell Westbrook, we did mention that him attacking the rim was certainly opened up a little bit, but he did most of his damage with the jump shot. So just in the stretch of time, so that starting at that 920 mark, but running through the entire rest of the game, not just the third quarter, Westbrook had 33 points and he had 4 free throws. So that's actually fewer maybe than you would expect given that. 3 of 5 in the restricted area, 1 of 4 from floater range. So still had some struggles there. 3 of 4 on mid-rangers and 5 of 7 on threes. So the jump shot that had been not falling for a vast majority of this series, and we said was going to be the kind of the central question in this series, that was really what helped spring OKC. And of course, Paul George also had 21 points of his own. So you can't do it without either one of those guys. But Russell Westbrook hit every single shot that he had to down the stretch.
And you can maybe question Utah for not doing more to get it out of the hands of Westbrook and George, considering that those two combined for 79 of their 107 points and, you know, probably 80% of their points in the second half. You can definitely question that. But, you know, Utah, they didn't want to overreact to that. And I think in the next game, they're not going to want to overreact either. I mean, their strategy was, Russell Westbrook, you want to be us for mid-range? Go ahead. But that mid-range jumper that's open most of the time, especially with Gobert, again, a little gun-shy with the foul trouble, and same with Favors. And by the way, Favors' fifth foul was awful, too. Like, he just went straight up. I had no idea how that could possibly have been a foul. But those mid-range jumpers feel a lot better when you're actually stopping them at the other end. That can become a better shot. If you're trying to outscore a team when you're giving up 120 points per 100 possessions and wide open corner threes all the time, then that jumper looks a lot worse, right? And they got back to the formula that worked for them last year. It was funny, Danny, while Westbrook was really struggling in this game, we got asked during the Twitter NBA show of what's so different about Russell Westbrook this year. And I thought that one of the things really was his mentality was a little bit different, and that he almost could be more effective playing the way he did last year, 1,000 miles an hour, shooting without a conscience. And I think he maybe had too much of a conscience. He wasn't taking the open mid-range. He was trying to make passes that just weren't really there, or driving into traffic and feeling like he was taking, you know, trying to avoid taking bad shots. And he had really largely abandoned the three-pointer about halfway through the season, was he wasn't shooting it well. But, you know, when he really goes off, especially in this comeback mode, you'll remember too, last year he led a ton of these comebacks where he was just like shooting every time, right? That was part of why we had him for MVP. And I think that especially in this series, he's got to just be Russ and play with abandon. And sometimes it's going to look really, really ugly, but other times he's just going to keep going and be too relentless. And eventually the defense is going to crack. And I think hitting those 2 3-pointers, which was kind of like, which he hadn't really been shooting when he's just like, all right, screw it, I'm going to start taking these. I think that was a really important step for him.
It certainly appears that it was that way. And there were a couple other important elements of this comeback and everything else that I wanted to mention. So Westbrook and Paul George didn't sit during that whole time. That's been talked about, you know, as you mentioned, only the second time Russell Westbrook has played the entire second half. Steven Adams only sat for a minute and a half, and I thought he was very important for this as well, just because he gave them this added degree of rim protection. And even though he only scored 2 points, he can help create space for other guys as well.
Yeah, he was an excellent screener. He was doing a great job of like engaging with the big under the rim, preventing help on some of those drives. Running the floor, he was very solid. I mean, it's pretty amazing. The Thunder had 13 assists on 39 made field goals, and that's a 33% ratio there. That's about as low as I can ever remember seeing. I mean, usually the league worst team in terms of percentage of assisted baskets is at like 50% for the season. But, you know, it was just George, it was Westbrook creating everything, and the Jazz had no answers. Anything else you wanted to add in here before we kind of talk about what this is going to mean for Game 6?
A couple other things. So you mentioned the assist ratio. It was also 8 of 23 during the comeback and the end of the game. So it was true before the comeback. It was true after that they were running in that way. And then the other guy I want to talk about, we said some about the difference between Jeremy Grant and Carmelo. Alex Abrines is not a perfect defender. He has flaws. There were times when the Jazz went after him a little bit, including with Donovan Mitchell late, but he plays with energy and he's willing to body guys up. And I thought he was a major difference maker, and that playing him over Corey Brewer for a lot of that stretch, though they did go to Corey Brewer late, sort of similarly to how they went to Melo late, it helped them on both ends of the floor, because offensively you have to guard Alex Abrines. He can hit open shots. Everybody knows that's why he is in the NBA. But he worked as a defender pretty well, shockingly well to a point, in what Oklahoma City was trying to do.
Yeah, he actually had two steals and a block, and he got beaten a couple of times by Mitchell. But Abrines' problem isn't his quickness necessarily, and he can also at least like pressure up and give some effort. It's that is his lack of strength, and Utah doesn't really have the wing player off the dribble who's going to take advantage of that. I thought Mitchell had some fabulous finishes in the lane. I mean, that one lefty floater after someone dug down and probably fouled him, there was no call, and he floater off the left foot, and he was outstanding getting to the rim, but he just couldn't get to the rim every time, and the jumper wasn't falling. He was only 1 out of 7 on threes. Many of those were very difficult attempts, but you know, he still was their best option rather than Ricky Rubio. And so you know that Snyder, if he thinks they're going to be switching, he's going to dial up some stuff that's a little more systematized for them to deal with that switching defense. But it was weird to see the Jazz just have to go to mismatch basketball in this one. And we probably didn't talk enough about what Grant did when he came in. I mean, the blocks, both he and George Abrines, all of them were just getting so many deflections when they're trying to throw the ball to the weak side. They would make it much more difficult. There was more pressure. There's just that little bit smaller window to finish at the rim, and Oklahoma City looked like Oklahoma City again, and just that level of franticness. Grant was only 2 out of 2. He had a big dunk on a pick and roll. I can't remember what his other bucket was, but again, he was and they only went with Felton for 4 minutes. Patterson they brought in briefly. I still thought it was lunacy to go back to Carmelo, and it's not like he gave them anything at the end there. But you know, Donovan, I guess, still in spite of all evidence, believes that Carmelo has to be back in the game. Maybe it's still just politics, although you know, you would think that when Grant fueled their entire comeback, that would at least be enough to take him, Carmelo, out and put Grant back in. But you know, Melo was good enough that he didn't get killed, and they were able to outscore him 29-21 in the fourth quarter.
Well, and that ties in with where you wanted to go before we started talking about Abrines and Jeremy Grant, which is, what do you take from this moving forward? And my biggest question is, what does Billy Donovan take from this moving forward? Because it took until the second half of an elimination game when they were down 25 for OKC to try anything different.
You know what it reminded me of, actually? Worked. You remember how in that series with the Spurs against OKC in 2016, it took until the Spurs were down 25 in game 6 in the second half for him to try Kawhi Leonard at the 4 when they'd been killing him with Cantor and Adams together the whole series? You know, that's kind of what it seemed like. We'd been calling for it all series. That's kind of what it seemed like here. We've been calling for him to change the pick and roll coverage all series. They finally do, and hey, it works, but it just happened to be enough with the combination of these incredible Westbrook and George performances and the Gobert foul trouble. So yeah, I think it is. So, you know, what is he going to take from this, getting back to your point there?
Right, because you could say there will be a way to go, oh my god, well how can you possibly turn your back on what made this team successful? You know, beyond Russell Westbrook and Paul George going insane, partially because of Rudy Gobert being out, the attacking defense with Abrines and with Jeremy Grant. But you look at the way Billy Donovan chose to end this game, and this was not garbage time, you know, late, that he went to these guys when the outcome was still in doubt, going back to Corey Brewer, going back to Carmelo Anthony. And my instinct is that Billy Donovan is going to start game 6 that same way. He's going to start with his guys, and if it falls back to it, maybe he will turn to that lineup, but it's going to be a different circumstance. Utah is going to be at home. That crowd is going to be in a very different mental state than most we've seen, because it's this weird mix of, hey, it's a closeout game at home. This would be a massive series win for the Jazz with. We just saw what was a crushing defeat in a very limited window. But if that window expands, then you start to think of this not as much like an example you brought up in the Twitter show of the Warriors blowing a lead in a closeout game in Dallas in the We Believe year, and starting to look more like OKC blowing game 6 in the 2016 Western Conference Finals. And those two things are very different, but the line between them can be faint.
Yeah, and really to me, a lot of what they did is not sustainable. Like George George, Westbrook combining for 79 points. That's very, very unlikely to happen in the next game. Like the math that Utah has generally forced in this series has worked. OKC's offense has looked really bad. Gobert has been dominant. Now he could get into foul trouble again, but he doesn't start game six in foul trouble. And so just George, Westbrook playing this number of minutes, certainly they were fueled by the crowd in OKC, which actually started booing when they had gotten down 25, according to Royce Young. Very unlikely that those guys play the same way again, and especially with Rudy Gobert out there and not hampered by foul trouble, if in fact that is the case. The thing that they can replicate to me is the defense, whether it's switching, whether it's being a little more conservative with their center placement. And so you said, oh, is Donovan going to start with his guys? My even bigger question is Donovan going to start by switching? Are they going to put that in their back pocket and try it later? Are they going to just go with a more conservative scheme with Adams? Like, what are they going to do? Are they going to say, oh, they'll be ready for the switching, so we're not going to do it, we'll go back to our regular scheme, which they've proven time and time again they are unable to execute against this Utah Jazz team. That'll be really, really interesting to me. Can the Thunder maintain their composure? They actually did maintain their composure in this game despite getting completely blown out. They found that far more difficult to do in Utah. Like, that's the question for me. And if this OKC team can stop Utah, I don't think they're going to score as well as they did here. You know, they're not going to go 9 of 21 from 3, I don't think, with Russ going 5 of 9. But the question is, if OKC can defend as well as they did in this game, then they can turn this into a rock fight and it could be anyone's game at the end. If they go back to the same old guys that they had been, or Snyder maybe can find a counter to the switching, then, you know, because Utah has clearly been the better team for nearly the entire series. It's taken superlative individual efforts from George and Westbrook to even get them the two wins that they have. And this sets up my absolute favorite scenario in the playoffs. And this was the case even before that classic Golden State game 6 in Oklahoma City, which is favorite down 3-2, heading to the other team's gym for a game 6. Both teams really desperate. The favorite can still salvage it, get back home for a game 7, really proving your mettle, or the upstart underdog can just end the series. And I just love game 6's 3-2 to the road team. This is my favorite. I can't wait for this game.
It's going to be fantastic. And I mean, we already saw some of the postmortem stuff with Oklahoma City, and those stories are basically the same if they lose game 6 in terms of what happens with Paul George and everything else. We don't know if that's going to happen. Obviously, that's what makes this game so much fun. And there are plenty of stakes involved in this game either way, just like there were massive stakes in what we thought for 90% of this night was going to be the story of the day, the game of the day, Cleveland overcoming Oklahoma City.
Indiana.
Oh my God, how did I get that wrong?
That's all right. We've been talking night. For like 8 hours total today, so you're allowed to make that mistake. We don't do edits on this pod.
I had such a beautiful narrative flow going too.
I know. I this is one of our better transitions, which we usually kind of fail at. And Indiana had a nice halftime lead of 7 points, 56-47. They really were hurting the Cavaliers, who had resorted to switching a lot. They did not go with the double teams of Victor Oladipo early. And Indiana did a great job of attacking those switches. They had Oladipo working off the ball more. Their bigs were getting great steals. Lance Stephenson threw some fantastic entry passes to those guys. And Indiana looked to be in relative control, especially with the way that they had dominated in the second half. And then it was a 32-17 third quarter from Cleveland. And LeBron, just through three quarters, was absolutely unbelievable. He was 9 of 11 at halftime and was shooting basically every shot in the paint or getting fouled. Through three quarters, he was over 30 points again. He was just absolutely dominating. Bojan Bogdanovic, they had the shooting around him. When they didn't have the shooting around him, Indiana was still totally unable to get any kind of help at the rim from Turner, from Young, from Sabonis on LeBron. I mean, it was just a relentless performance by LeBron. He also was 15 of 15 from the foul line. He had 8 of Cleveland's 16 assists in this game as well, did end up with 5 turnovers. I thought that even at times in the first half, he was providing some decent rim protection. And yet, as they have in this series, the Pacers just kept coming. You felt like with Cleveland up by 10 for end of the third, beginning of the fourth, they'd be all right. It wasn't even when LeBron went out of the game. They only lost 2 points during that. It went from 6-4 at that point. But then Cleveland totally stopped scoring, only 17 points in the fourth quarter, and they got right back into it, I thought, with some weird tactics by Cleveland defensively.
Yeah, again, one of the questions that can persist in a playoff kind of idea is, what are you trying to gain from what you're doing? And I had some of those questions with Cleveland Cleveland's approach, especially in that fourth quarter.
And Victor Oladipo was 2 of 14, and yet they decided all of a sudden to go back to this trapping defense that Indiana had largely solved, I thought. And why they felt like they had to double team a guy who was 2 out of 14 down the end of the game, I really don't know. But we'll do possession by possession down the end, but it seemed like they were really opening up a lot of plays. Could have been even worse for the Cavs. I thought another thing that really changed things was after LeBron finally started just completely abusing Bogdanovich off the dribble from the top, they just going right to the rim. They went with Thaddeus Young on LeBron, and obviously no one is going to shut down LeBron, but Young at least has enough strength that he was able to just prevent himself from completely getting trucked. And it happened at that time that LeBron started getting a little bit more tired. He only went 5 out of 13 from the field in the second half, got more of his turnovers in the second half as well. So I thought that was a key adjustment from McMillan, who, you know, because Young has always been the best matchup, but they felt like, oh, we want to have someone who can guard Love, who can switch a pick and roll with Love. But Love, again, pretty limited, 2 out of 11 in this game. His post outs were not very good. He did get to the foul line on two really bad calls in the first half, by the way. But he has not been the post threat in this series. And I think they felt like they're okay putting Young onto LeBron. I mean, when you're getting trucked that badly at the rim, pretty much anything would be better than that. And that's kind of what we were saying at the time was, you know, someone's got to come in and help at the rim, even if Cleveland is going to get some open threes. And again, I mean, Cleveland did not hit their threes. They're only 31%. So I don't know. Anything else you wanted to say about the meat of this game before we talk about the very end?
Yeah, a couple of things. One, LeBron's shot chart in the beginning of this game, you talked about it a little bit, but I want to mention this more clearly because it's so completely insane. In the first half, LeBron was 9 for 11 from the field. 10 of those 11 shots were in the restricted area. The only one that was not was a 10-foot banker, which didn't go in. And he only got to the line twice, but also using that threat was able to create a lot of the looks for teammates. And early on, it was another story like we've seen so much in this series where LeBron is creating great looks for capable teammates, not just for the dregs or anything like that. And they're not converting. J.R. Smith missed all three of his threes in the first half. Calderon missed an open one.
Yes, Smith.
Hood missed an
Smith,
open
by the
one.
Way, 33 minutes, 0 points, 0 for 8, 0 of 6 from 3.
Mm-hmm. And really, the only guy who was hitting shots even in that first half, and that largely held in the third quarter, outside of LeBron, was Kyle Korver. Korver was converting those opportunities. I think he had 4 threes in the first three quarters, and then Calderon eventually joined him in the third quarter as well.
And remember, Kyle Korver only played 4 minutes, I guess because he still was coming back from that foot injury in game one, and how screwed would they be without him right now in this series? He's their second best player. Kyle Korver is their second best player on this team right now.
Yeah, and again, in this game, Cleveland did not get much from all of the players they acquired in the trade. George Hill again did not play. Calderon started in his place.
And by the way, we said it at the time of the trade that maybe investing in George Hill, who, you know, really has not been able to stay healthy 3 of the last 4 years, might not be great at playoff time. You might have some nagging injury, and as it turned out, that was the case.
Yep, and the inconsistency, basically all the reasons that Utah Jazz fans were not super depressed when Rodney Hood got traded, a lot of that stuff has come to pass in this series as well. He finished the game with 21 minutes, 1 for 4 from the field, missed his only 3. And I think with Hood, you've used the phrase, and I really like this with him and with a couple other players, that he doesn't play with force defensively. Rodney Hood is 6'8", but if you watch the way he defends, you would never know it.
Yeah, I mean, they had Korver out there late for defense rather than Rodney Hood. You're on a defense-only possession. That's not the
greatest. They also had Jeff Green out there for an offense-only possession, so there are some questions here. But
yes, that is true. Well, let's talk about the end of the game here. I'm sure this will get us to a few more of our themes coming.
Yeah, I'm realizing now I haven't talked about my big theme yet for the Pacers from this entire game. So I think we'll get to it in this, though.
Yeah, coming down the stretch, they had a couple of passes, one to Young, one to Sabonis, that just didn't work. And then I thought one thing that really stood out to me late was the Pacers having chances to push in transition, especially Oladipo, and just not doing it.
And that's exactly what my main point was, and you're right to bring it up in the fourth quarter, but it was true the entire way. In the first quarter, there were times when Victor Oladipo looked like he had a seam, or Darren Collison. I think Collison in some ways was
turning
almost
down
as big
so
an offender.
Many shot too from three. I mean, the guy's a 40% three-point shooter. Shoot the ball.
Yeah, turning down shots, turning down drives, and Cleveland, A, their transition defense is abysmal, but also even in just normal situations, other than LeBron, they don't really have much in the way of help defense. Their centers are Kevin Love and Larry Nance, not exactly a buffet of rim protectors in any way, shape, or form. And Indiana, maybe they were worried about fatigue with their guys. They did end up having a lot of players who went deep into the minutes. I mean, Oladipo at 40, Bogdanovich at 33, Sabonis, who played well at 33. But you need every point you can get against Cleveland, because you know that they're going to score, especially if it's close late.
Well, and also remember, Cleveland's transition defense was one of the worst in the NBA this year, right? And the pace of this game was incredibly slow. It was like 89 possessions. So, and maybe Oladipo was too tired to push the ball, but Corey Joseph only played 27 minutes. He could have done it some. Lance likes to push the ball, but you know, and they did have 14 fast break points in this game. But I thought especially late, and pushing in transition late can be such a weapon. Teams are just not prepared for it. They're tired. But in any event, this is when they started the double teaming. We'll pick it up at 95-91, just over 2 minutes left. Oladipo gets a long rebound in front of Calderon after Calderon missed a three, and he just had a chance. His momentum was already going down court, and he just slowed it up. But then they just double team he and Sabonis. Totally predictable. Oladipo throws this left-handed pass to Boyan, and it could have been a more accurate pass. You know, Oladipo, he's in his first year really being this initiator, and he's got to get more passing vision. He's got to get more craft. You know, he's a million miles an hour right now, and that can be very effective at times, but I think just in terms of his skill level as a passer, and he's going to get there this year. You know, this is being a number one option is very difficult in the NBA, especially in the playoffs, and he's going to learn how to deal with that. But still, Bojan Bogdanovic, wide open three. He makes an unbelievable play, knowing that he's off, goes and grabs the rebound on the fly, and then he found Young for an easy layup. Not much hustle from Cleveland getting that rebound. So that made it 93-92 with 2 minutes left. And LeBron got Sabonis on a switch. Sabonis has actually been relatively effective on LeBron. LeBron really went a little bit too slowly, I thought, against that Sabonis switch. He had to go to a fadeaway in the lane. He just didn't quite have enough time to get something in. And again, Victor Oladipo had a chance to push the ball, did not. You know, they were in transition. But of course, then they just double teamed it again. They don't get anything, though. They got back in order. Joseph had to drive, but Indy was able to get another offensive rebound as Love was just only able to tip it out of bounds. And then they did a smart sub of Green coming in for Calderon, because it was actually Green who on the ensuing possession somewhat forced a miss from Sabonis, although I'm sure he would tell you that that was an easy lefty layup. And Sabonis was great with 22 points, 8 out of 12, despite, you know, just incredibly left-handed right shoulder finish every time. Even Brent Berry brought out that stat on the broadcast too, which was a great one of how he Mike Savagno had this after we were talking about him being Zoolandering, that on 96 of 101 possessions in the post, he went right shoulder this year. It's just incredible.
And we saw Thaddeus Young finish with his right hand.
He's
on one play.
Improved. Sabonis tried it once.
He has.
It did not go in. I mean, but if they're not going to stop you, why not just keep doing the same thing over and over again?
Well, and it was so funny to see Cleveland's ancillary players just not know the scouting report. Like Rodney Hood, there were a couple times when Sabonis was posting him up and he just didn't know what to do. Yeah, but
Jeff
then other
Green
guys,
too,
like if LeBron
got Sabonis just score and they flash to LeBron on the benches when LeBron's on the bench and he's just like, can't believe that they let him go right shoulder again. Yeah, but Sabonis missed that layup, and then they come back down. LeBron gets a drive, throws it to Jeff Green in the corner, and I think two guys went to Green, who had hit a three from the top of the key earlier when LeBron was out. But probably you'd rather have him shooting than Kevin Love. But then they actually managed to contest Love's three pretty well also. And again, they had a chance to run on the rebound. They didn't. But again, it was a very soft trap by Cleveland. They had previously on the Bogdanovic wide open three had brought Korver all the way in off of Bogdanovic to take away the roll man. They didn't do that this time. And Indiana did a great job of throwing it to Joseph on the wing. That was Oladipo getting off the ball. And then they rotated out to Joseph at the three-point line, leaving Sabonis just wide open. Whoever, I think Love was one of the guys who was guarding Sabonis who double-teamed the ball up top. He kind of jogged back into the play. This had been a long period without a stoppage, so he might have been tired, but he just jogged back into the play, and Sabonis at the free throw line caught the ball, like pumped once, and was just shocked he was so wide open. It was just a warm-up jumper for him. He hits it at the free throw line to tie it with 33.6 remaining.
And then there was a timeout, so teams got a little bit of rest, and Nate McMillan, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe he left Sabonis in, did not bring in Miles Turner. Part of the reason Turner was out was Sabonis outplayed him. Part of the reason also was that Turner had five fouls, so that kind of helped.
And I thought
bled into the other.
Just was doing a better job even defensively.
I agree with you.
Although Turner actually had decent success switching onto LeBron. Amazingly, he might have, in the first half, he actually might have been their best switch defender onto LeBron, because Boyan was just getting smoked so badly. But yeah, I think keeping Sabonis in was the right move, and it looked to me like they were trying to set up a hammer play along the baseline, and LeBron sweeps around from the left wing all the way along the right lane line to the right baseline, and as he winds up to throw a pass to the shooter in the opposite corner, Thaddeus Young makes a great play. He had hounded him the whole way, did not get knocked backwards, and knocks it out of LeBron's hand, and then it bounces back up, hits LeBron's hands, and goes out of bounds. Everyone says, all right, off of LeBron's hands, we're going down the other way, timeout. And then there was never even a review as far as I knew, but it was obvious on the replay that Young had actually hit the ball down into the baseline, making it out of bounds before it bounces back up and goes off of LeBron's hands. And the fact that it was never reviewed is pretty surprising to me. It certainly seemed like it was obvious, but I think we had this, I can't remember which game it was, it might have been a Warriors game earlier in the season, where there was a big scrum along the sideline, and it turned out that the ball had gone out of bounds with like 5 seconds left, but the actual out of bounds call wasn't made until there was 3 seconds left. And so when they reviewed it, it turned out that they couldn't review even further back in time to see that it had gone out. They could only review the actual incident that was called out of bounds. And so perhaps had they looked at it, they would have considered it a different incident, because the ball was knocked down once and then bounced back up and went out again, that they wouldn't have been able to go back and overturn the first time where the ball went out of bounds, because that's not when it was called to be out of bounds. But as far as I know, I don't think they ever looked at it, and they didn't, maybe because it was late in the game or what, but I don't think anyone, they ever did the pool reporter on that. And then that set the stage for Victor Oladipo on the other end.
And this play was intriguing for a couple of different reasons, the biggest one being the Cavs were switching, and Indiana ended up deciding to attack. Victor Oladipo attacked with LeBron on him, even though Korver was on the floor. And see, you could question that just on the idea that LeBron is a better defender than Kyle Korver, but Victor Oladipo blew right by LeBron.
Yeah, and maybe the thought was, well, we don't, and Oladipo had some success on LeBron, although he got one blocked as well earlier in this game, I believe, on chase down. Maybe the thought was, well, we need to run the time down here. There's a 2 second differential, and if we run the risk, if we involve Korver, that they double team, and then if we started it late, we're not going to have time to ping the ball around, or that we'll end up going too early, or we might get a turnover and a pick six and let them score. The paramount concern is we don't want a turnover, and we want to be able to get the last shot. Of course, they did not get the last shot, as it turned out. But Oladipo, I mean, I said it on the broadcast, oh, they broke LeBron's ankles, and it looked like he did, but LeBron recovered incredibly well. But as it turned out, not well enough. He committed a goaltend, but because, again, the referees did not call the goaltend. Usually when it's close, you'll see them call it a goaltend, and then they can go back and review it. But because no goaltend was called, they didn't get a chance to do that. And J.R. Smith got the rebound with 3 seconds left, and LeBron likened the situation to the Minnesota game earlier that I picked as my game of the year on our awards podcast, because LeBron getting a block and then hitting the game-winning shot. But here's the difference was Smith got the rebound and actually called timeout immediately without dribbling. He didn't repeat his mistake from the Minnesota game. And so they brought the ball into the front court, and then that set up LeBron's heroics.
And thanks to the broadcast not really setting the scene and settling in on their camera angle far enough before the inbound to actually see what the hell was going on, it took going through replays to actually really get it, because sure, you saw what LeBron did, but one of my first questions before we saw the replays was, why didn't anybody come over to help? Sort of paralleling the shot you talked about before, where Andrew Wiggins didn't come over to help. Well, the difference this time was there wasn't enough time, because nobody was close enough, because the ball wasn't in the air as long. It was thrown from half court rather than being thrown from three quarters. And so LeBron caught it, and there were some I saw on Twitter questioning why Indiana didn't foul, because they apparently had a foul to give. The answer is because when it's only 3 seconds, it's way too close. You don't want the ref to call a shooting foul and just completely screw you, because if that happens, then you know the other team's going to get a chance. You already burned some of the time off the clock. So I get why Indiana didn't foul, and when there wasn't anybody there. So
yeah, and also LeBron caught the ball on the move. Young was not really close enough to foul him immediately.
True.
And LeBron was able to make a move going to his left, and the design of the play was excellent so that there wasn't someone else there. There was still, it was almost that you couldn't double because there was too much time left, right? Because LeBron had enough time to make a pass pass potentially, and Joseph was guarding Korver. That was the nearest guy, and it really wouldn't have been realistic for him to come over on LeBron. And LeBron, just an incredible shot, only his second made jump shot of the game on 14 attempts or 14 make.
Yeah, I was actually, that was one of the stats I was sitting on in this, because I just found this so fascinating. So LeBron, he only took two shots outside the paint in this entire game. They were also his only two made shots in the fourth quarter.
Yeah, maybe what you could say is, and that is incredible, he also was 15 of 15 from the line. I'd be hard pressed to remember the last time LeBron shot that many free throws in a game and didn't miss one. Now maybe what you should say is, it's so obvious it's going to LeBron that you should just double team him and not let the ball get inbounds to him. Let anybody else beat you except LeBron. But there was enough time left again that they could have just gotten it right back to the inbounder with 3 seconds left. And the inbounder was Jeff Green. So, you know, maybe you should go ahead and double team there, but that's a lot to ask on the fly to figure that out. But especially in that situation, I think it probably, you got to do something to get the ball out of his hands at that point, whether it's just whoever the closest guy is goes and doubles, or the guy guarding the inbounder just basically like stands there and tries to prevent the ball from going into LeBron or whatever it is. And just say, hey, you know what, if they throw it back to the inbounder, someone just sprint to the rim and try and contest him there, or Jeff Green will give you an open shot, because it's just, and LeBron just has such an amazing record. And of course, it was very reminiscent, just about the exact same spot on the floor, though I thought this was a more difficult shot, of his shot from game two of the 2009 Eastern Conference Finals against the Magic. Cavs went on to lose that series, but now of course they lead 3-2. And anything we need to discuss about this series going into game six on Friday night?
Well, I think you knew that when you mentioned that in passing that I was going to go on to Basketball Reference. This was the first time in LeBron James' illustrious career that he has taken 15 or more free throws and made all of them.
Okay. I mean, and they needed every single one of those, obviously. Then they ended up 26 out of 27 from the line, only 21 out of 27 from the line for Indiana. And again, it seemed like Indiana had just so many missed chances. I don't want to say, like, Indiana is clearly the better team here, but it's just, you know, LeBron is putting up these incredible games. I mean, this is another one, 44 points. That other game where he had the 49. I mean, these are the Herculean efforts that are required, and they're barely winning these games. I mean, they've got Jose Calderon at the floor at the end of these games. Jose Calderon was basically replacement level last year. Like, I was saying that the Warriors, like, shouldn't even sign him, and they should keep Briante Weber instead. Calderon actually, you know, has hit some shots in this series, but this guy's playing in crunch time for the Cavs. This is not a good Cleveland team. It is just an absolute struggle for them. And some of the pieces that they maybe could be getting out of, like Clarkson or Hood, I mean, they have no offensive system. So, you know, Hood's not going to get some of the shots that he got in Utah. And Clarkson doesn't really have enough free reign to kind of go off. He had that big first half the other day, but that's really all he's done in this series. J.R. Smith just can't hit a shot other than, you know, a 75-foot fading three-pointer at the end of a quarter. It's basically just like Korver and LeBron. Even Love is just incredibly limited right now. I don't know how much of it is that.
Did we ever even say LeBron's line for this game? Because we might as well have it if we have.
Yeah, 44 points, 10 rebounds, 8 assists, 5 turnovers, 14 to 24, 15 to 15 from the line. I think we did it piecemeal, but it does need to all just be repeated at once. Pretty incredible. A little more efficient than Russell Westbrook's 45-point performance when he did it on 39 field goal attempts.
And for the series, LeBron is averaging 35 points, 11.5 rebounds, and 8 assists on 55% shooting and 83% from the free throw line on 11.5 free throws a game.
And for the Pacers, I mean, Victor Oladipo, like, I don't think he's getting terrible shots. I think he was forcing it to the rim a little bit. His finishing has improved a lot, but in this one, didn't look as good. His overall shooting performance was 1 out of 7 from 3. I mean, I thought he got pretty decent looks on those, but I mean, the real problem, and he should have been 2 out of 6 at the rim because that was a goaltend at the end, was 1 out of 6 at the rim. And it did, I mean, I think for Pacers fans who are really going to feel aggrieved about this, I mean, number one, the out of bounds call was missed at the other end. That deprived Cleveland of a chance. And then number two, LeBron hit a three anyway. So even if Oladipo makes that two, I don't think that the Pacers would have been in an appreciably different defense up two, because a two can tie you. Maybe you're a little bit more concerned about the three because that's the only way you're going to lose. But still, I mean, I don't think there's a way that they could have stopped that LeBron three. So if he makes a two, I think you're feeling a little bit more aggrieved. But the fact that he hit a three, I think it's harder to say that the refs cost us the game, especially when they blew a call in your favor, not 30 seconds for.
And part of what's so bizarre about this series, you talked about the Herculean efforts it has taken for LeBron, is that Indiana, it feels like they leave so much out there. and yet they're still either so close or winning a lot of these games. In this one, transition, I think they left a lot to be desired. A crazy stat from this that I think reflects, you know, if I could put one thing in from Nate McMillan, it would be this. Indiana in this game, 1.6 points per play when they were in transition, 0.83 points per play in the half court.
Well, and another thing that they will absolutely ruin this game is 15 out of 27 at the rim, only 56% against one of the worst rim protecting teams that we've seen in the playoffs in years. And granted, with LeBron playing a little harder, that became more difficult. And I thought he made some big plays protecting the rim, particularly in the first half, actually. But they're going to rue that as well. Oladipo will think about a lot of shots that he had too, that he's been making all season, but has not really made in the last three games of this series.
Something else I wanted to say, because this could end up coming in game six, Darren Collison was awful in this game. He didn't miss as many shots as Oladipo, but Collison didn't attack defensively. He wasn't really bringing as much, and it was completely justified that Corey Joseph played over him late.
Yeah, Joseph has been awesome defensively. He's one of the best in the league as a defensive point guard. He's really the only guy who could stick with Korver. I thought that Korver really was able to beat Oladipo, and that Love would do a really nice job of screening his own man once Oladipo was beat to get Korver some open threes, but Joseph was able to stop Korver. I thought he was really important there. But Collison, I mean, he's got to be the secondary scorer. They don't have anyone else to do that, and he's turning down three-pointers, only one three-point attempt. He had so many chances, I thought, to take spot-up threes. He's getting Kevin Love on a switch. He's just got to be aggressive. He's got to go crossover, get to a good mid-range jumper against Kevin Love. Like, with how terrible the offenses have been in this series, although they actually were better in this game, it was just an incredibly slow pace, but that's a good shot. He needs to just be aggressive and shoot that one. Anything else you want to say here before we talk a little raps, Wiz?
No, I think that's enough. Indiana, I'm not sure, considering they're a relatively young team, if they're going to be haunted by losing this series, but they certainly have had the chances to win it.
Yeah.
If they end up losing,
do you expect them to win
them
game
to.
Six?
I do not.
I mean, well, I will say this. I'd be shocked if it's not close. I mean, every game in this series has been close,
yeah,
except the one that Indiana blew out, right?
Yeah, I think that's fair, but also, I wouldn't be surprised really by any outcome in this series. These two teams have been very uneven within each game, so I could see it being a blowout, but I don't expect that. You're right, I expect it to be a close game too. It's been a very consistently interesting series, even if it hasn't been beautiful the whole time, and I've enjoyed it a lot.
A less interesting series has been Toronto and Washington, in particular because I just feel like Washington can't score on Toronto in the half court, and they can score on them in the full court. This game, Washington, fifth percentile in half court points per play, 72.6 offensive rating in the half court, but they added 13.9 points more than expected to their ledger in transition, almost, and ran 47% of the time off live rebounds. That's all John Wall, but they, Beal, Wall, these guys are not very good half court creators. In the Washington games, they did a little bit better with that Wall and Gortat pick and roll and finding Gortat, getting him involved. But generally, as long as Toronto has gotten back, they've been able to stop the Wizards pretty well. And in this game, the Wizards only managed 98 points on 97 possessions. And in particular, they struggled in the fourth quarter when they were kept out of transition. They looked a little tired. There were a lot of stoppages. Toronto was scoring. They were getting the foul line. And so they only put up 20 points in that quarter, but it was like 27-15 during the competitive portion. And Toronto actually ended up going up by 13 late, although it was much, much closer than that. The other thing I'll say from Toronto's perspective is part of why I remained skeptical about their playoff chances was DeMar DeRozan and Kyle Lowry. I thought that they would not necessarily produce in the playoffs. They haven't proven that yet. And DeRozan, pretty nasty game, plus 15, 32 points, 12 of 24 from the field. He hit 3 of 4 from 3. And while I thought Washington continued to do a pretty decent job of running the reps off the three-point line, Lowry and DeRozan were able to create enough of their own three-point chances. They had 6 of their 11 three-point makes, and through most of the game had a large percentage of those three-point makes. Then a few other Raptors made some as the game went on. Wright was 2 of 2. He was awesome in this game, by the way. He had some huge steals in the fourth too. What stuck out to you about this?
A lot of big plays. He had DeLon Wright had a kind of a 5-0 run at one point, as I think it was, went from a 1-point lead to a 6-point lead during that time. Wright made a 3 and got an alley-oop layup off a nice pass by DeRozan in transition. But for me, in the first half, I think one of the big stories was just DeRozan going off and being relatively efficient about it. 20 points on 13 shots, 15 shooting possessions, because he was 4 of 4 from the line. And in that first half, Lowry and DeRozan had 5 of the Raptors' 10 assists. Now, 10 assists on 18 made baskets. Yeah, I mean, that's you're okay with that just because they were getting some of it done from the line. But it really was those guys delivering and the support players being support players. And along those lines, this was not the best game for Serge Ibaka and OG Anunoby. Anunoby looks like he tweaked his ankle late in the first half. I was encouraged that he did play in the second half, though he did not figure significantly into the ending of the game.
Yeah, and Ibaka, he only played 23 minutes. He has not been able to get it going offensively since the first two games, that when I think he had over 20 points in both of those. Instead, it was a closing lineup of Wright, Lowry, DeRozan, Valanciunas, and CJ Miles. So they really went to an offensive group down the end with Miles at the four, and I thought that that opened things up for them offensively. The pressure from Wright really was pretty good, and Washington was not able to take advantage because they don't have that wing player, right? I mean, they have some of the same weaknesses of like Portland and New Orleans, for instance, where they don't have someone who's going to just attack hard in the post off the dribble from the wing. Otto Porter is not that player. Even Markieff Morris, they went back to him and he wasn't really able to do much rather than Oubre. I think that's part of why they went there, was because it was they were going with Oubre and Porter at the forward. Nonetheless, Washington had their chances. John Wall played 44 minutes. I really think they got to find a way to get him some more rest, especially they have capable backups. The Raps bench without Van Vliet has not been anywhere close to what it's been. They've had to play their starters much more, but nothing crazy. Still 38, 39 minutes, and I think that made the difference. Wall just, he gets tired down the end of these games, and they can't score unless Wall is at 100%. Maybe the home crowd can push him up in game six, but I also thought that Valanciunas was really good down the end for the Raptors, finishing inside. He had a nice play on Beal late where he rotated over, forced him into a pull-up, and then still was able to get back and box out Gortat and rebound.
Oh, I thought you were going to talk about the steal he got, because he ripped up, I think that was John Wall, and got one of the steals, which ended up, that was the one that led to a DeRozan dunk, I believe.
Yeah, that one was awesome as well. We didn't expect that. Wall got ripped up a couple times right in a row there, leading to fast break buckets. There's another one that Wright had where Wall tried to chase him down, and Wright is just such a good finisher. He just wrong-footed him, went to the other side of the rim, no chance to block it. That was really impressive. I just love Wright as a finisher.
Oh, one other thing I wanted to mention in this game. It's becoming a broken record, but damn it, I'm going to keep making this point because it's important to me. Remember how the Wizards did so well, surprisingly well, with Satoransky in place of John Wall? Satoransky only played 4 minutes in this game. Ty Lawson played 14, and Scott Brooks is still kind of trying to make, you know, they're doing these Wall-Ty Lawson minutes together, partially because they just don't have that other kind of guard player. But I think they just need to trust Satoransky a little bit more, because giving John Wall 40 minutes or 38, I would be targeting 38 if I were Scott Brooks. I think that makes Wall's 38 minutes meaningfully better, and Satoransky can hold the fort down. He did it for a month.
Yeah, and even Lawson, you know, was plus one of those. You did mention that he played some minutes together with Wall. Also, interesting also that Mike Scott, only 14 minutes in this one. I mean, he's still, with them being unable to score in the half court, you know, I'd like to see him get a little bit more of a look playing at the four. You know, it was Oubre and it was Morris, who again did very little. 6 points, 2 of 8. Oubre, 3 of 11, 1 of 7 from three, although he did get to the foul line for 7 of 7. So Mike Scott, you know, I don't think that the Raps have really been able to hurt him that much defensively, and they can't score in the half court against this team. Now, I will say I probably expect the Wizards to be slight favorites in this game six. It wouldn't shock me if the Raps finally take care of business, and they showed impressive mental fortitude in this one. I mean, they were down 86-82 with under 9 minutes to go in this game, and then they went on a big run to clinch it, mostly fueled by their defense. And Bradley Beal also just had some pretty good looks that I would say okay looks mostly. He had one big three that he missed that could have cut it to three with about 2.5 minutes left, but he really was not able to create the offense either. And just, you know, John Wall and Brad Beal are not elite creators in the half court. They're solid. They can run it down your throat, but when it breaks down, John Wall is going to get to an elbow jumper off a switch or off a conservative pick and roll coverage, and Beal is going to get a pull up too that's probably contested if he runs a pick and roll, and those just are not that great of shots.
Yeah, I mean, doesn't it just feel like this is going to go seven anyway, though?
Oh yeah, well that's why I picked them. I should wipe wipe that smug tone out of my voice because the rest of my picks have certainly sucked.
Well, one that you got right, we both got it exactly right. One of the few exactas on the board. The Houston Rockets, even though this game was, and this whole series, I mean, was closer than expected. Minnesota actually led by 4 points at halftime. Then Houston, again, just went on this huge run in the third quarter, 30-15. So we both picked Rockets in five. The Rockets won in five, so we can do a very faint celebration because we got this one right.
Yeah, is that the only one we're getting? I guess it still remains to be seen.
I got a couple right.
Yeah.
I got Warriors in five correct.
Yeah.
I might get I have like, I think I could get five exactly right still.
Yeah, no, you could get Celtics. That's probably trending your way. Jazz in six, I think you had two.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was closer on Sixers Miami. You had that one going seven, right?
I did.
Yeah.
You had it in six, I believe.
Yes, that is right.
We'll go through all that later on. We still haven't figured out a scoring system, but we will figure out something.
Yeah. All right. We should discuss that. I mean, it's so funny because once we're done, we're spending like, you know, 8 hours a day talking about basketball. So it's like, once that's over, it's like, you know what? Maybe there's someone else in our lives that we might want to have a conversation with at some point.
Yeah. But I'll just talk briefly about this game and then I'll plug my piece so I can remember to plug it myself. I thought that early on, you know, Paul and Harden just weren't really getting anything. And that is not something that you would ever expect to hold. Harden ended up with 24 points, 8 of 11 from the field, only 4 free throws. And Chris Paul didn't get any free throws. But another nice game. I mean, maybe the biggest surprise of this series, other than Karl Anthony Townsend, this kind of ties in, not really finding himself until this game where I thought he played better, was Clint Capela. 26 points, 15 rebounds, 12 of 14 from the field, 2 of 4 from the line, 4 offensive rebounds. And he just had a wonderful series.
Yeah, that was outstanding. And he was really able to benefit as time went on. I mean, number one, I thought his defense on Karl Anthony Towns was excellent, although when it was a one-on-one matchup, certainly there was plenty of switching on Towns. The other thing, though, was that they're playing the pick-and-roll two-on-two as much as they could, although they still gave up plenty of threes in the series. And Karl Anthony Towns is not exactly your best two-on-two big pick-and-roll defender, and so they're able to get a lot for Capela. And when Capela gets a lot of shots, he gets a lot of points because he is an extremely efficient finisher. Good note here from Jonathan Fagan, and it showed just how little pressure the Wolves defense was able to put on Houston. The Rockets, despite the fact that there were some relatively high possession games in this series, they only had 42 turnovers in the series, so under 10 per game. That's just two more than the fewest in NBA history in a five-game series, and especially with Paul, Harden, I mean, those guys do not turn the ball over very often on a per-possession basis, and Houston finally got the three ball going, especially in the second half. Tucker was 5 of 7, Ariza was 4 of 7. When guys like that are hitting threes, this team is completely unguardable. They finished 41%, 18 of 44. That's their usual preposterous number of attempts. Wolves, 19 three-point attempts. They did make 9 of them. And it ended up being, for Houston, just offensive domination in the second half. 134 offensive rating on only 90 possessions. They had 122 points. So, I mean, playing really slowly and yet able to put up this incredible efficiency. And Minnesota finally had an efficient offensive game of their own. I guess they had one in game 3-2. 114 offensive rating, and they lost by 18 nonetheless. And I'm ready to see the Minnesota Timberwolves go home. I mean, just their utter lack of creativity in being able to attack this Houston switching defense, to me, is a problem. Also noteworthy in this game, Jimmy Butler did not play in the fourth quarter due to knee soreness in his surgically repaired knee, which, oh, you know, maybe that's interesting. Maybe, you know, you shouldn't play him when you're down 30 to start the fourth quarter, the entire fourth quarter, 38 minutes of the previous game, and then maybe you won't have knee soreness the next day or 2 days later.
And remember, this was an 11-point game going into the fourth quarter. It was not over, though I think you and I both thought it was not going to go Minnesota's way. And, I mean, Jimmy Butler sat in the All-Star game because he needed the rest. And so to go in that direction, I mean, with Thibodeau, it's extremely concerning. I still fully expect Thibodeau to be the coach of the Bulls next year and to be the president. I mean, this is a very different situation
than
Stan Van Gundy. Because
you mean the Wolves. He is not the coach of the Bulls any longer, or the president.
Oh, I wish I would have fumbled that into Timberwolves, which is actually what I kind of wanted to do, but I didn't. That's how I made the mistake.
Sean Hyken would have managed to recover that.
Of course he would have. Yeah. And so you have all that. And where I was going with that, why I lost my train of thought, was because this is, I had already written it, but a lot of this stuff in this game tied in with it. The first of my off-season previews for The Athletic, I'm writing in-depth, you know, big storylines, things to watch, all the, you know, the little nuances, also like picks and all that, all that sort of stuff is in there. And Minnesota is in this such a strange place because they had, I don't want to go into their whole offseason thing, but this is just kind of the crux of what I talked about, is they had such a tumultuous and active 2017 offseason that this one is going to look tame by comparison. And I don't exactly know if Minnesota fans are feeling good about what happened this season. I mean, they made the playoffs, ended this 14-year playoff drought, which is massive, or if it's like, hey, you know, we did all this stuff and we only got one game in the playoffs. We ended up being the 8th seed. But I think we're going to see an overwhelmingly similar team next year. And that's kind of what the crux of it is. But I talked about what they can improve as well.
Well, yeah, but when Tom Thibodeau goes back and really assesses his philosophy and what went wrong this season, you know, I'm sure they're going to come back with a radically different strategic approach. So I expect big things for them next year.
35-minute workloads for everybody.
Yeah. At least, you know what's nice at least is that like the Bucks have at least started competing in their series. You know, like I don't feel, I mean, those are sort of the two teams of utter frustration this year. And while the Bucks have certainly still done some frustrating things, at least they've been defending. They've gotten to a more modern approach. So we do have some news to get to here real quickly. Mike Budenholzer has seemed quite possible after he had already been linked to the Suns job, although it was said that they were not able to come to an agreement because I guess Robert Sarver was not willing to pay him anywhere close to what he was making. He's said to be interested in the Knicks with that to be his top choice. We'll see if that's actually true, if say the Bucks job or the Blazers job were to come open. But he now will not return as coach of the Atlanta Hawks. He had 2 years and about $14 million. Mark Stein said yesterday on the show that he had heard it was even more than that. So I'm not sure if this agreement is anything like a buyout from Atlanta. You know, maybe there is and then there's not much of an offset, or maybe they agreed to let him out of it with the idea that there would be an offset. We'll probably never find out exactly what that financial offset is. But Budenholzer is now a coaching free agent. I would say that of all the coaches available, I would probably put him at the top of the list, especially with the improvement he's been able to engender in young players. Very good offensive mind. He's coached very good offenses and defenses in his career so far. And now, if I have to give him any personnel power, I'm running away like my pants are on fire. But if he'll just come in as a coach, I would be very, very interested in him, I think. And who else? Is there anyone else on the market that you would be more interested in than him right now?
Terry Stotts isn't on the market at the moment.
I like Bud better than Stotts, personally.
Yeah, we discussed this a little bit on the Twitter show. I just like Stotts' offensive, like the way that he approaches big men who can shoot, I think could be very good for Porzingis. And I think the defensive approach that Stotts has used this year would be good with them. But again, I like Budenholzer a lot. I think Budenholzer's done, especially when he's had competitive teams on the floor, has done a very, very good job with the Hawks. And their young player development, certainly, you know, like the way that those guys have looked better over time. We didn't really get to see it much with their young perimeter players this year because Bembry in particular just missed so much time. But overall, they've done that nice job, and it would be fun. I'm trying to think of the last time this happened, to have a coach and a former protege, a former assistant, coaching in the same city on the two different teams would be kind of fun, with Kenny Atkinson doing a good job in Brooklyn still.
Yeah, and we'll see what happens, of course, you know, with this, the Bucks here, if they can make it to the next round. They are certainly massive underdogs to do that now, but you know, I could still see them winning in Boston. They've been close there a couple of times in the series. They obviously have to win tomorrow night, but I think that they're pretty good favorites to do that, the way they played in the two games in Milwaukee already. So that's gonna be fascinating. In other news, this college basketball report came out today. I haven't read a summary of it yet, but certainly the Twitter summaries that I've read were not particularly complimentary from an NBA standpoint, although they did ask the NBA to eliminate the one and done rule. The NBA and the NBPA have had conversations on eliminating the one and done rule. Brian Windhorst basically saying, yes, that's going to be done. Woj saying this as well, but that the minimum age requirement won't go any sooner than the 2020 draft, which makes sense because you've already got players who were being in the 2019 draft who've already committed to college and stuff. And also before the NBAPA's executive committee meets in June, it would be impossible to make any kind of a change to the CBA, the collective bargaining agreement. But Windhorst said on TV today that the one and done rule is going to be gone. The NBA is going to try to take charge at youth basketball, get in a more productive way than just, hey, we're going to show up to your AAU tournament, apparently, so that teams can make informed decision on these high school players, whether, you know, that means you could be drafted, but you have to be in the G League for a year, or, you know, who knows what kind of a form this is going to take, what kind of the options are going to be. But I think this makes more sense to me. It makes our jobs a little harder because we don't have have that college game tape now to evaluate guys before the draft. It makes everyone's jobs a little harder, but they're trying to find a way for the NBA to be involved in youth basketball that's more productive than it was in the first one and done era. And I certainly, whatever they do, will make a lot more sense than players going to college, although I still suspect that players will do that to some degree.
They did before. Yeah. And I think more importantly than any sort of, I agree with you that it will be harder for us, but from an equitability standpoint, I think this is extremely important. And I'm a pragmatist in a lot of different ways, but one of the easiest arguments that I've ever had to make with this is, would you give up that first year of LeBron or that first year of Kobe for any good reason? I mean, though there are certain players who deserve to make that jump, who are ready to make that jump. And the NBA is a better place for nurturing even talented players who are not ready to make that jump than colleges. You know, like, let's say Michael Porter's back injury had happened, exactly the same thing occurred, and he was on an NBA team. Not saying anything against the University of Missouri medical team, I know absolutely nothing about them, but when you consider the investment involved in an NBA player, you know, you have them on a four-year contract. If he would have been drafted high, Michael Porter certainly would have been. They have all of the incentives to do right by these players, and I've the book Boys Among Men, which is fabulous, by Jonathan Abrams, which if you haven't read it, if they change the age limit, it's mandatory reading. It is anyway. But the NBA is going to be so much better about handling this now because the league is just more professional than it was 20 years ago, 15 years ago.
Yeah, and I think actually even that some of the kids coming into the league are a little bit more professional and polished than they were years ago. And everyone just kind of knows how to do this better. And I think even if you look back at the history of high schoolers from 95 to 05 being in the draft, and those guys who went in, I mean, there's selection bias there because they were good enough to go to the NBA in the first place. But most of the guys who were amazing talents ended up really fulfilling their NBA destiny and being awesome. And, you know, especially because guys are going to college for 1 year like this, and it's just kind of, you know, they're just not learning how to play NBA basketball. You have another year of learning how to play NBA basketball. You practice all your threes from the three-point line. I mean, it's just, there's so much more that you can do. You learn NBA defense. You're not playing in a 2-3 zone at Syracuse or something, or, you know, just desperately trying to stay out of foul trouble with five fouls. And it's going to be much better here. A couple other things. I will take this one. Actually, one other thing. I will take this one because of your
actually,
policy.
This isn't about the recovery as much. So I'm free to talk about this, but you can take the lead.
All right. Woj said on TV, basically, that the relationship with Kawhi Leonard is broken and there needs to be a meeting, which Mike Wright also reported would be a priority to happen relatively soon. Obviously, with Greg Popovich and the tragic loss of his wife, it may not be imminent here, but that there needs to be more communication before the Spurs feel like they can make that designated player veteran extension. But really, to me, what everyone again is not focusing on enough is this guy actually healthy? Is he going to have a recurrence of this quadriceps tendinopathy issue? He has a team of doctors that apparently has not cleared him, unless that's just some kind of an obfuscation because he didn't want to go back to the team. When he proves that he's healthy and the Spurs believes he's healthy, they seemed already, but they apparently Leonard and it seemed disagree, then a lot of these conversations can start. Another interesting detail though from Wright was that Peter Holt and his wife are in the midst of a divorce, and that could mean that it would be a difficult sell for them to make this big commitment to Kawhi. Maybe that sounds like almost if they're in the midst of a divorce that perhaps the divorce proceedings could result in them having to sell the team. That's, I'm just reading between the lines of Wright's story here. I don't know that that's true, but if that's the case, you know, that adds another wrinkle here as well. Do you want to make this risky investment for a team that could potentially be sold, or just simply because it's in the midst of a divorce could just be paralyzed, and maybe, you know, they're an acrimonious divorce could just mean that, hey, you want to do this? I'm not letting you do that. You know, it could just be even be something like that. So that throws yet another wrinkle into this, even if they do want to make the offer of the designated player veteran extension. So much remains to be seen here with Kawhi. My prediction is still that it's all going to get worked out, but I wouldn't shock me if it went the other way.
It wouldn't shock me either. There's a lot of pressure on different elements of this, and you could just think of when they'll have the opportunity to kind of sync it up. The parallel here might even be Kyrie, where it's just, if they don't get to a resolution by X date, like, will they be comfortable going into this season with Kawhi Leonard not being on a new contract? And to get the numbers out there, I just did this very quickly. If the cap for 2019-20, because that's the year the extension would kick in, if the cap that year was $108 million, which is the current estimate, that Kawhi Leonard designated vendor extension would be adding 5 years and $219 million to his salary, to the books. It would be the largest contract in NBA history in terms of new money. There might be some kind of finagling on all that because of the years added and all that kind of stuff, but 5 years, $219 million would be jaw-dropping.
All right, well, that'll end a jaw-dropping night of NBA action. Same programming as last week, by the way. This week, with only one game tomorrow, we're going to wait, and then Friday night, we'll wrap up all the games on Friday, and also that Thursday game. We got pretty good listenership from doing it that way, so I think we'll stick with that at least for this week, and then we'll assess, of course, as we next week comes into view and we know what timing is going to look like. Thanks so much for listening. You got something there?
Sorry, I was going to quickly promo my piece again. The Athletic, the Minnesota Timberwolves offseason preview, it goes into a lot of different directions. And also, I think I mentioned this before, but I did a piece on the 9 teams that I think are most likely to use cap space, some of which are relevant right now because they're getting knocked out of the playoffs, but going to be doing an absolute metric ton of writing for The Athletic, some of which we'll get into Patreon and Danny Storytime, but a lot of it, because we're doing offseason previews for Dunked On, will largely stay in that place.
All right, we'll talk to y'all Friday night. Till then.